Well, it's nice to have been a big part of the, you know, the Heyman story, because they weren't around for that long in the grand scheme, were they? You know, so it's and tell me, was that your introduction to 24-inch bass drums then, Heyman? Is that where that kind of?
Actually, no. Ah. So in 1974, I did my first trip to New York. I was playing with Danny Gillespie, and we couldn't take any equipment, but I did take my cymbals because we didn't have work permits. And so after this long flight on an L-1011, sitting in the back, getting high, of course, because in those days you could, and the stewardesses would come get high with us, which was great, rolling up joints in the back of the plane. And we land, and we watched Death Wish. Herbie Hancock, I think, did the music. And I'm like, wow, that's going to be New York. Okay, here we go. We land. And, of course, the moment we go through immigration, we're all given red folders. Go and wait in that room. Oh, God, here we go. And but then magically, Tony DeFries, who was the main man, he was the manager who managed David Bowie. And these limos must have arrived outside. Somebody came in, spoke to immigration. All of a sudden was, all right, you can go. And give us the red folder back. Oh, there you go. And they stamped our passports and off we went. We were through. And so the idea was that they were going to buy all the equipment there. So off I went down to Manny's with the sound engineer and my drum tech and Roadie, by the way, we used to call them. Yeah. Way too grand a name. In fact, some of the older guys still don't like the word tech. They want to be called, I'm a roadie, not a tech. All right. You know, so funny. So we go to Manny's, and I'm like a kid in a sweet shop, you know, and I've never seen so many Ludwig drums and Slingen and Rogers up on the shelves, all the sizes that you could never get in England. And I saw one kit, it was a white pearl, and it was like two 22s, 12, 13, 14, 16. It would have been perfect. But oh no, I had to go and get a Ludwig Octoplus because I was stunned by the first picture I ever saw of that kit. I said, what do those toms sound like? We went next door to Sam Ash, and they had, it had already been sold or reserved, I think, a Butcher Block Ludwig Octoplus with 24-inch bass drums. And the sound engineer said, all right, we need this kit. What's it going to cost? And I think he gave him a couple of extra $100. He said, it's yours. So, which was the most stupid kit to have for that gig, by the way. But what did I know? I was 17 years old. I was more, I just wanted to see how it was. And there was a manager happy to buy me a drum kit, which was great. By the way, it wasn't mine. But so I started tuning, setting that up. We were in RCA Studios, Studio C, which I remember on an album cover, Buddy Rich had recorded there. So I was like, wow, you know, tuned it up and set it all up. And that was my first time with 24s. But of course, when it came to doing a gig, I couldn't use the whole kit. They said, get that off the stage. You can't take up the whole stage. And I'm like, So I ended up with a, you know, two toms, two, like a floor tom and two rack toms, something like that. Big sizes, you know, 24, 18 inch floor tom and 14 and 15 or 13 and 14, something like that. So that was the first time. Once I'd used the 24s, I went, Then I went back to 22s when I got back to England. And they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't give me the kit. So I don't blame them. But then when I had the, you know, when I got the kit made or, you know, recoated and I got the 24s, then I went back to using 24s. I've always kind of switched between 22s and 24s, depending on what's going on with the drum kits, you know, the drum kit manufacturers.
Makes perfect sense. Well, look, Simon, I said we'll be no more than 10 minutes, and hey, I'm more than happy to sit and listen to you. But it's, you know, it's like being in heaven.
Oh, thank you. So, well, it's lovely. I remember just, you know, reading the catalog, seeing all these drummers, and some that I knew were in certain bands. I remember Bob Henrit, and it was like, wow, you know. So I thought, well, I must be in good company. These must be good drums, you know. I think I really do think it was an opportunity for English drummers to use an English drum kit, which financially made a lot more sense, because in those days, I don't know what it was, probably the import duty or something, it made it made American drums, which we all wanted, really, but it made them out of reach for us, for most of us. And I think Heyman supplied a drum kit that was more like an American drum kit. And it was an opportunity for everybody to get on board with a different kind of drum kit than was available to us here. Because the Japanese drum kits hadn't really started arriving yet.
Sure.
You know, that was, I think that was 70. Well, Tama, as we know, this is its 50th anniversary. I don't think we really saw many Tamas until 75. And Pearl. I think Pearl, 74. It was a friend of mine bought a Pearl kit. It was the wood and fiberglass mixture.
Oh, yes. Great drums. Yes.
Remember those? Yeah. And also, Tama, if I'm correct, came out with the first boom stand I ever saw.
Ah.
It was a friend of mine, keyboard player, who used to play with the Bee Gees, Jeff Wesley, he came back from Manny's clutching this Tama boom stand. He bought me a boom cymbal stand. That was so sweet of him, so lovely. Oh. And I was like, wow, you know. So, and then I saw the Ludwig ones. I went, ooh, you know. So, anyway.
It's quite hard to imagine, obviously, you know, I'm from an era when boom stands were just, you know, just standard things. And
right.
Logistically, it must have been amazing to have a boom stand. You can put things here and move them over the top. That must have been incredible because you don't think about that when it's there in front of you, do you, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, you know, I remember playing a double kit with straight stands.
Wow.
And I remember seeing, you know, all the drummers, or Billy Cobham. Hmm. You know, when I first saw him in 74, straight stand in the middle between his four racks, straight stand there, straight stand. I still use straight stands when I can, actually. I just love the way they look and the way they, you know, they're really, you have to get them kind of tight into the drum kit, but they're kind of easier to memorize where they are. But that front one, that's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I have a 19-inch cymbal in the front, or actually it's to kind of because there's a splash. But it just makes more sense with a boom stand. That's all it does, you know. Cymbals react differently too, depending on the stand that they're on.
Yeah, I can know.
It's a subtle one, but the type of stand, like the type of cymbals, I will change the type of stands that I use. So if I'm playing bebop, like it's a straight ahead gig, then I'm using a very different kit. The small, you know, small kit, sometimes an 18-inch bass drum. Depends on the bass player, actually. I say, who's playing bass? And if I know the bass player, I go, I should use an 18. When I used to play with Dave Carpenter, he had this big sound. He had very high action on his upright. I could use a 22, no problem. But with Alfonso, for example, he's a closer action, a lighter player. The 18's better. It doesn't overrule the bass. It's a very subtle thing playing straight ahead. The bass and the bass drum and the bass really have to complement each other. And a lot of that comes in the playing. Same with cymbals. I use Constantinople's with playing bebop, so they're much quieter. I use different sticks, so a different bead on it to get a slightly lighter sound. I will use the bottom of the range Tama cymbal stands, the lightest ones that they make that don't fall over, it helps with the resonance of the cymbal. It's not so rigid,
right.
You know. Yeah. That's why Peter Erskine uses flush bass stands, because instead of your stand here being attached at the bottom of the tube and halfway up, well, not halfway, a third of the way up, which is holding it much more rigidly, with a flush bass stand, the cymbal stand's liable to do this, which means there's more flexibility, which affects the way the cymbal sounds.
You know, I've never thought about that.
I know. It's very subtle. It's great. I had a long conversation with Pete once. He was he came to my studio when I had my studio in Sherman Oaks. I was recording him for a project. And we just sat down and started rapping. It was great. Lovely. And that's one of the reasons he left Yamaha to go with DW first and then now Tama. And they make flush-based stands. Isn't that amazing?
Wow. That's I don't think it would affect my playing, I'll be honest.
No, it's very much, you know, you have to be playing at a much lower level to really have the subtleties of that. Yeah. But it's quite interesting.
Yeah.
You know, so it's I really enjoy, you know, doing a show where I have to play very differently, play really lightly most of the time, but keep the intensity, you know. It's really fun. It's great. Yeah.
Well, look, Simon, I've taken far more of your time than I promised I would. It's always a pleasure. And honestly, I really appreciate you giving your time so generously. So thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
It's breakfast time here. I'm going to make some breakfast. I've got a vocal session coming up, so excellent. I've got a set up for that. So,
well,
not me singing, by the way.
No, well, I was going to say, you never know.
I'm just recording.
Fantastic. Thanks, Simon. Honestly, right. I really appreciate it. And hopefully,
my pleasure.
Speak to you very soon. Take care.
Okay, thank lovely. You. Thanks.
Cheers, Simon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. All right.